Back together again, you and I chatting it up on a midweek Wednesday, April 16th, 2025, on Connecticut Today, where I commented on a tax day proposal the day before from Democrats in Hartford to hike taxes on many upper-income earners. Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor Dan Harp chatted with us about energy policy and a controversy surrounding Secretary of the State Stephanie Thomas. CBS News correspondent Olivia Rinaldi joined us from D.C. with the latest legal news surrounding the Trump White House. And yes, while our landmark legal foundation go-to guy, attorney Mike O'Neill, analyzed a declaration from a federal judge to possibly hold the Trump White House in contempt in a controversial ongoing immigration case. And it's become an almost yearly or every other yearly occurrence here, but gotta talk about it because one of these years it's going to happen. You may say, well, doesn't really affect me, but in kind of a way it does, and it indicates the health of the state. What am I talking about here? Well, yesterday, tax day, April 15th, hope you got everything filed or maybe an extension or whatever your situation is. Hopefully you're getting money back. About a group of about 30 progressive Democrats gathered in Hartford yesterday saying, hey, we need to tax the rich, tax the more. That's original, huh? Tax the rich. Where have I heard that before? So there are a bunch of things that this cadre of progressive Democrats, about 30 House members and some Senate members, do because they say the rich aren't paying their fair share. And there are different ideas here, a flat-out 1% surcharge on top of the money they're already paying. If it's an individual making $1 million a year, if it's a couple, a married couple or cohabitating couple filing jointly, making $2 million a year, there's an idea to tax unrealized capital gains. There's a mansion tax, whatever, yada, yada, yada. Now, this hasn't happened over the last 5 or 6 years because, frankly, Governor Lamont is a rich guy. And he knows a lot of these rich guys that may get PO'd by this and say, hey, Ned, love you. I'm out of here. Because people do leave over money. We talked about this yesterday with our friend Megan Portfolio from the Yankee Institute, who the Institute pointing out here every tax day, and I have those figures for you coming up, more and more people have left the state of Connecticut. Now, are they leaving only for taxes and expenses? No, there are family concerns, whatever. Maybe they want to get away from the snow and the ice 5 or 6 months a year. I get it. I understand it. But we again heard yesterday from this kind of broken record, if you will, from some House and State Senate Democrats said, well, tax the rich, tax the rich, tax the rich. Now, they came up with a figure yesterday that even a small basic tax on the rich could generate another $171 million a year, which isn't a lot of money. It's not a lot of money. If you're talking about $26, $27 billion a year, $171 million, it's not chicken feed, but it's about 0.6%. Okay, so My first question is here, is there a real fiscal means to the end here, or is it just a notch in their belt? Hey, putting a notch in their belt. Hey, we tax the rich people. Here's the real problem that nobody ever wants to discuss in this state. I cannot remember the last time this was discussed in any earnest, mode. Way, shape, or form here. The same politicos in Hartford and all around the state who will say, hey, all those rich people in the state. Now, they don't actually come out and say it, but you know they're pointing at Fairfield County. They're pointing at Fairfield County. The millionaires, those who make $5 or $10 million, there aren't too many of those in New Haven. There aren't too many of those in Bridgeport or Hartford or Meriden or Middletown or Danbury. All this stuff about taxing the rich is clearly just the way you've got the people yammering about zoning. It's all in the crosshairs in Fairfield County. They may say it, some may not, but we know what that is, right? But the bigger question nobody ever wants to take into consideration here is a simple one. Why is Connecticut, which once was a hub of manufacturing, which once had a lot of corporate headquarters here because of tax policy, why is the state of Connecticut so dependent on Fairfield County? Why is that? Why? And I know you're going to say, well, it's the New York people. Yeah, it is. I'm not going to deny that. It's been that way for decades here. Because at one time, believe it or not, Connecticut was considered a tax haven. But why does anyone not ever discuss in any way, shape, or form the fact that once you get out of Fairfield County, except for a few spots in the state, there ain't a whole lot of income tax revenue generated by folks in Connecticut? I don't know why. Is it a cyclical thing? Is it a demographic thing? I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at a map right here, and it was easy to find. It's not hidden anywhere. I looked up basically some Connecticut state income tax data. It's not hard to find. A simple Google search. I found it in about 22 seconds. And it's stunning to look at. If this state didn't have Fairfield County, it would be dead. You would have the other seven counties would be a festering corpse if you didn't have the money coming in from Fairfield County. And yet, you've got Democratic leaders in Hartford saying, give me more. Give me more, sir. Oh, Mr. Hedge Fund guy, give me more. Here's what nobody in Hartford will really want to consider in any way, shape, or form. Why is Fairfield County still the lifeblood of this state? Why is one county carrying the load for the other seven others? And it is. If you look at the numbers, dispassionately, it is. So are you into asking or answering that question, or are you into maybe just yammering away like a bunch of Democrats did in Hartford yesterday? So we start off with this. And it's our Facebook question of the day to start right here, facebook.com/voiceofct. Do you agree with a proposal from Democrats in Hartford for a 1% state income tax surcharge on the richest residents in the state? They say, hey, if you did this right away, it would raise $171 million. Really? And how long would that last before it goes to 1.5% or 2% or 3%? Are we taxing the rich enough in this state? Should we tax them more? Should we tax them less? And explain to me, Lucy, why does Fairfield County consistently carry the rest of the state on its collective back? And this is never, ever, ever really debated by the majority in Hartford because they don't have an answer to it. And it's a simple question. Why does Fairfield County continue to carry the state on its back when it comes to income tax revenue? Now, I know what you're going to say. The obvious answer is because, look, there are a lot of people in Fairfield County that work at headquarters, corporate headquarters in here. And also, more importantly, though, in New York City. Look at Metro North every morning still to this day. But it makes me laugh every year, and it happened yesterday on tax day, no accident. Hey, listen, they can market well for no other reason. But you have majority Democrats saying, hey, all we need is 1% of a surcharge on rich folks, singles who make $1 million, couples who make $2 million, and that'll give us another $171 million, and that'll help us. Well, yeah, it helps. It's not gonna stop. So the high earners in this state who already pay an outsized amount, as they should, of income tax here in their state, in this state, they continue to be the ATMs here, which I'm sure some of them don't mind because they make a lot of money. I get it. I understand it. But what about the other seven counties here? With all due respect, I mean, obviously, it's south of Danbury, south of Bridgeport. It's a different world. And yet, instead of coming up with ideas, really creative thinking to get the other seven counties in the state to kind of catch up with Fairfield County and some other individual areas and amongst the other seven counties, instead of doing that, it's always, hey, let's go back to the ATM. I mean, come on. It's lazy by the majority in Hartford. It just is. But it's all they have. And now they're floating yesterday about, well, maybe a capital gains increase, maybe another mansion tax, maybe this, that, and the other. I have an idea. How about figuring out how to keep people here in Connecticut? Because, yes, some people leave because they're sick of being the ATMs to the state. And instead of going back and saying, insert card here and putting your PIN code, could we do some other stuff here? Yeah, I get it. High-income people live in Fairfield County. But can you imagine the steaming, floating hulk this state would be if Fairfield County didn't exist? Thank God it's attached. Thank God it's here. So instead of getting, like I say, this any sort of creative thinking about, hey, how can we generate more revenue in the other counties? Never happens. It's all about, well, let's do this, let's do that. A tax here, a tax there, a tax everywhere. And meantime, they do nothing. Well, let's create a bill to have companies like Amazon make sure they're honest with their workers. Oh, and let's keep chasing the tail of Avello Airlines. That helps, too. There is nothing that comes out of the majority in Hartford that moves the state forward. It's always catch up. It's always patching the holes. It's always, who the hell can we get money from now? And yesterday, the gall of them to do it on tax day. My God, it's like twist the knife, will you? And Ann Hughes, what she said about taxing her people, caught on a hot mic. I mean, come on. Can you be any more cavalier? But they don't care. They don't care because the majority in Hartford never entertains ideas as to keeping Connecticut on the cutting edge. Never. Whether it comes to power generation, whether it comes to efficient use of resources, whether it comes to law enforcement, whether it comes to educating our kids, nothing new, nothing on the cutting edge. Let's patch a hole there. Let's patch a hole here. And again, I'm not saying I have the answers. I sit here and say, well, no, I don't on this one. But man, all you got to do, I found this map with a color coding here as to which areas of the state pump in how much money to the state income tax fund. Wow. And I remember Governor Rell telling me this years and years ago when I used to talk to her all the time. She would tell me on the air on my show at another station, Paul, thank God Fairfield County is attached to us. Because if it wasn't, what what would we be good for? But again, you have the majority in Hartford to say, well, let's just take a little more from those people. And you know, if we took just a smidgen more from those people, oh, and just a little more for those people, eventually, you know what those people are going to do? They're going to flip you the finger and they're going to leave. And they're going to leave. And we had some rather interesting goings-on of the Capitol today regarding energy and all that and some controversial stuff. Dan Haar is with us. Hearst Connecticut Media, senior editor and columnist. Mr. Haar, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm okay, and everything's fine. The Capitol is busy. Energy, Housing, education, we weren't going to talk about, but we might have to, so let's do energy.
Yeah, let's do energy. John Fonfara, outline what went on there today, Dan, because we have some kind of interesting alliances on what's going on there. What's up?
Yeah, before we get to the political alliances, he's essentially saying that he agrees with Republicans. I guess this is the political line. He's agreeing with Republicans that the public benefits portion of your bill should be borne by taxpayers not by ratepayers.
Okay.
Right? And this is anytime anybody says, I can cut your electric bill by 20%.
Yeah.
Right? As they said when we were kids, just, you know, listen to them, but run. Because there is no sort of easy solution to cutting your electric bill. So what the Republican members of the House are saying, and now John Fanfara and apparently some other Democrats he's gotten along with him, including some of the leadership,
yeah,
is saying, let's take this public benefits portion of your bill, which is large, not for the reason people think it's large, but because it pays for energy purchase agreements. Mm-hmm. It's not large to pay for clean energy programs, conservation, and it's not large to pay for your low-income neighbors who can't afford their bills. Those numbers are pennies. It's large because of the Millstone surcharge that guarantees a rate to Millstone in order to bribe them to stay open because they threatened to close. That's why it's large. Let's be clear. In any case, for whatever reason, that's one thing he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing he wants to do is take procurement for the standard offer. In other words, under 1998 deregulation or re-regulation, electric customers can go buy their supply from Paul and Dan's electric house or from the default from UI or CL&T, right? Eversource. And so he wants a separate agency, a new authority to buy power because he thinks – he isn't saying this, but he thinks that Eversource, maybe he thinks they're not doing a very good job. But one critic, Tom Swan, who's an energy policy guy, who's private, you know, Connecticut Citizen Action Group, said, you're just adding a layer of bureaucracy. So this has been a debate for 30 years that I'm aware of. And so that's really where we are, 25 years, I should say.
Interesting.
And that's what he's saying.
Okay, it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. Our esteemed Secretary of the State, Stephanie Thomas, she's got herself, and I talked about this briefly yesterday, Dan, she's got herself in a little bit of hot water, doesn't she?
Yeah, she went to a conference, which was ostensibly an education conference for registrars of voters. Right, run by the Registrars of Voters Association. It has ROV in it, like Rove, you know, CT Rove or something like that. But that's obviously supposed to be nonpartisan. And at that event, she made a comment about the Nazi SS in respect to Trump's and the Republicans' election reforms, election changes. I am in agreement with opposition to those changes, right? They want to be draconian, let's not say Nazi. Okay. They want to be draconian about who can vote. So it is a very good debate. And I would say that there are two issues here. One is she speaks the unspeakable using the N-word, which we're not supposed to do, regardless of what this president does. And the second is that she does that not in a gathering of Democrats or at a rally, but at a nonpartisan event where she has the hat on that is the chief election official of the state of Connecticut. And so she went too far, regardless of what hat she's wearing, and B, forgot which hat she was wearing at the time.
Interesting. Dan Haar is with us, our weekly check-in, Hearst Connecticut Media, moving along on a busy day. You had a colleague there at Hearst, Dan, write a story, and I saw this, claims from the governor about building housing.
Well, we've all heard this. You know, this is not like Senator Blumenthal claiming he was in Vietnam. He may have said that once, but he certainly didn't run around claiming it everywhere like the New York Times claimed falsely.
Yeah. Okay.
They had a recording where he said once when I was in Vietnam. In this case, this is the governor running around everywhere, including in the State of the State address, saying we're building more housing, we're building more housing, we're building more housing. And so two of my colleagues, Jacqueline Ray Thomas and Alex Butterman, decided to actually look into that claim and found that, in fact, housing at us is at a 10-year low.
Oops.
Right. And so but there are lots of explanations for this. One is that their story is measuring housing that actually opened for business. right? In other words, the ribbon cutting, the opening of the door. This housing is done. And there's a lot in the pipeline. The other is that although the money is committed, it hasn't been spent, and in some cases isn't even in the pipeline.
Got it.
Because guess what? Lo and behold, it turns out post-COVID in Connecticut, it's hard to get a person with a hammer in his or her hand.
Really?
Right? Wow. I don't know if you've noticed it. I certainly have.
Wow.
Somebody wanted $4,700 to replace a doorway's worth of siding. I removed a doorway from my house. And for 3 years, I've had the doorway's worth of siding on the side of my house.
$4,700 for a doorway's worth?
$4,700.
Wow.
Right, exactly. I could send you a picture of
it. No, that's all right.
Right?
Wow.
So that's one thing. And the point is there are lots of reasons why housing is slowed. Mm. But I think the governor probably has overstepped his claim by saying we are building. What I think he means is we are allocating money, which at some point is going to be a building of. The other thing is that the governor is spending a lot of money supporting first-time home buyers.
Yeah.
And while that is very good and it gets people in homes and it's good policy, it doesn't lead to new construction directly.
Sure.
And so in that sense, he's right in saying we're supporting housing, but he's incorrect in that we are constructing new housing.
What did you want to mention about his briefings, Dan?
Well, I mean, he's had these briefings that the avuncular 68% approval rating.
Yes.
Ned Lamont came about, of course, as we all know from exactly 5 years ago, from his weekly and then daily briefings about calming everybody down and saying this is exactly the situation. He has begun those again. I don't know that there's one scheduled this week. I haven't seen one scheduled for this week. There may be one for tomorrow that I haven't looked on my emails. But it's a very similar thing.
Mm.
And the question, some people believe this is going to help him tremendously in the way it helped him in COVID, to be the calming force, and not just calming, but giving us really good, valuable information to live our lives in both COVID and now Trump. I should have said earlier, the briefings are about the assault on government by President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And some people think that he's squeezing himself in between two forces this time in a way that he was not the last time.
Mm, interesting.
That is, liberals are saying he's not going far enough, and conservatives are saying, oh, my God, he's criticizing the president. And so whereas in COVID, yes, there were a few people critical of the COVID, and later on in COVID, more than a few people, critical of the COVID protocols. For the most part, people benefited from this weekly, regular, or daily, regular briefing.
We carried them here. So, you know, listen, in the few seconds we have left, anything coming up that you're writing or anything else you want to tell us about here?
Well, I think it's important to mention today that the state where Education Secretary of the United States, Linda McMahon, came from and served on the State Board of Ed, today told Linda McMahon to go pound sand. They're not changing their DEI rules, and we'll see what comes of that. Connecticut State Department of Education becomes Harvard University, and we'll just see what happens.
Yeah, I saw that.
We should not let the day go by without mentioning that.
Yeah, I did a segment on that a little while ago. Great stuff, Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist. Mr. Haar, stay safe, drive safely, and we'll chat next week. Thank you, sir.
We're not running out of topics.
No. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. Shocking. There's more news out of the Trump White House. Joining us right now, CBS reporter Olivia Rinaldi. You see her on TV. You hear her on this station. Olivia, hi. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I, for one, am not shocked that there's more news coming out of this White House.
There's never a boring day down there, is there? What's going on now?
You know, there's really not a boring day, but today we got some news from the court.
Yeah.
Judge Boasberg, if you'll remember, he's the judge that when the Trump administration began these deportation flights to Venezuela, he argued that they are not supposed to do that and that there's a misuse of the Aliens Enemies Act that Trump was invoking to send these people from the United States, whether they were citizens or not, to Venezuela. That judge ruled and said that the Trump administration should not be doing that. We, of course, know that went all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Now that judge in that case is saying that the Trump administration, there's probable cause to hold members of the Trump administration in criminal contempt of court over ignoring his order that would halt the use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport alleged Venezuelan gang members. Just to level set and kind of broaden out a little bit, this is different than the case that has kind of captured our attention over the last couple of days of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who was the man who they are alleging is a Venezuelan gang member and that they deported. This is two separate cases, but we know that Judge Boasberg is perhaps considering launching this criminal contempt investigation. That's really big news.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you hear criminal contempt, and I'm having a couple of legal eagles on later on to talk about this, but that's not delicate language there, Olivia, is it?
No, it's certainly not. And this judge went back and forth, and he said, you know, he doesn't make this decision lightly. He added that none of the responses he got from the government in this case have been satisfactory as to why exactly they need to do this so hastily and without due process for some of these people. Also, by choosing this path of criminal contempt, Judge Boasberg has really left open the possibility that he might end up referring a lot of this matter to the Justice Department. Now, whether or not they take that up, given that it's Trump's Justice Department, is a whole other conversation. But still, it signals that he is really interested in doing some type of investigation, perhaps criminally, for members of this administration for ignoring his orders.
Wow. Final question, Olivia. Is there enough coffee down there for everybody? Because are the beverages still okay? Are they all right?
The beverages are still flowing in the morning and the evening. Certainly a lot of coffee. We prefer our Starbucks down here. So I've been getting a lot of Starbucks gift cards from friends. So it's been good.
All right. Olivia Rinaldi, CBS News. Olivia, thanks. And we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
There you go. Breaking news today. We have, you lose track here. You need a scorecard of all the legal actions against the Trump White House. But at least one judge in one of the legal actions here said something that's, to my untrained ear, sounds pretty serious. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. Our buddy Mike O'Neill's here, Landmark Legal Foundation, to hash that all out. Hey, Mike, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. Good to be with you.
Hey, Mike, what's going on here now with this judge who's talking about contempt and the White House staff and Mr. Trump? So lay this out for us.
Right. So this is arriving from a case. Interestingly, this is a case that was that the Supreme Court had weighed in on in a emergency expedited basis. This is a case involving the removal of those individuals, the members of the Tren de Aragua, the narco terrorism group.
Yeah.
And SCOTUS had weighed the initial petition for halting these removal proceedings was brought in the district court in Washington, D.C. Well, the venue and the jurisdiction of that district court went all the way up. That issue went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court briefly said, look, jurisdiction is not proper in front of this district court jurisdiction, and venue is proper in the jurisdiction of confinement. And these individuals who had been removed are currently the ones that haven't already been removed into El Salvador are residing in prisons in Texas and Louisiana.
Yeah.
So the district court in Washington, D.C. did not have jurisdiction. Well, the district court had ordered a halt to the proceedings. Remember, this was appealed all the way up to SCOTUS, and that's what did it.
Yeah.
Well, this was, again, we thought the issue was gone. We thought this court didn't have any jurisdiction, have any venue. Well, the judge today decided to issue an opinion saying that I have found probable cause that the administration, elements in this administration, violated my order when I gave the order before it was, of course, ruled improper by the Supreme Court. But when I gave this order, they violated it. And I'm going to hold them. I found that there's probable cause to believe that these individuals who violated the order, and I'm going to hold them in criminal contempt unless they comply with my order. So this is incredible. This is certainly a escalation of the conflict now. And I'm going to have to say this. I loathe to get into this terminology, but now we're seeing a showdown between branches of our government. You're seeing this district court judge is saying that there's probable cause to hold the administration in criminal contempt, which is a very serious finding by this judge. And incidentally, what's really important here is to understand this is this issue was taken out of his court. This, the Supreme Court said, you don't have jurisdiction or venue to hear this. He will come back, and his opinion's clear. His opinion is this. He concludes that, no, when I issued the order, the government, the Supreme Court hadn't found that I didn't have jurisdiction or venue. I know this is complicated, but it's necessary to explain this. So you had to treat my order as valid, and you didn't comply with it. Now, there's a couple things here. Number one, the administration is going to argue that, yes, we did comply with it. To the extent we understood it, to the extent you issued it, we complied with it. We did not have the power, however, to turn around planes that were in the process of removing these individuals over the Gulf of America. It was a national security operation. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the power. It wasn't within our power to do this. Needless to say, it wasn't also it goes without saying, Judge, it wasn't within your power to do this either, so there's that. Next. So I think the administration is going to, if to the extent to which they want to argue this, they're going to say possibly that they were complying to the extent they could. They had the power to comply with it. They could comply with it. Next, they're also going to argue that, look, this is unprecedented, Judge. You've never no court has ever held, no appellate court or Supreme Court has ever held that the contempt power extends so far as to cases where you never had jurisdiction in the first place, so you didn't have contempt power. So that's kind of a case of first impression here. Now, the judge will come back and say, look, I have contempt power because if I issue an order, you have to treat it as valid, and if you don't comply with it, I have contempt power. That's all well and good, but of course, this is an escalation, and we're dealing with a lot of separation of powers issues and a lot of powerful movements here. So I wish I had really – I don't like to see this because I don't like to see a triggering of a constitutional crisis. The judge, in my opinion, should have let sleeping dogs lie. If he wanted to issue an opinion, he could have said, if he wanted to get his pound of flesh, so to speak, he could have simply said, hey, I don't have the power to do any of this, but if I did have the power to do this, this is what I would have done. But he didn't do that. No, he did not do that. So now we're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, and Mike O'Neill's the guest from Landmark Legal. So, yeah, Mike, I mean, look, to my untrained ear, this even sounded weird to me. So now we're getting the kind of the narrative that, hey, this kind of feeds that narrative, Mike, does it not? And please tell me if I'm wrong, that there are members of the federal judiciary who are not completely respecting the power of a guy you may not like, but he has this power. Are we dangerously near that point?
As I said, Paul, I agree with this. To put it as delicately as possible, this is an escalation of a constitution. You're really ginning up trying to approach a constitutional crisis here, because at the end of the order, I mean, I'm reading this opinion. It's about 46. It's 46 pages. He's actually saying, hey, administration, you have to comply with my order. And in other words, you have to release these individuals. You have to take steps to see that these individuals who are currently being detained in El Salvador are released. At least that's how I read this opinion. And are you kidding me now? Wait a minute, Judge. You never had the jurisdiction or venue to hear this anyway. Now you're trying to interfere. You're trying to reach all the way down to El Salvador and compel an administration to go to take steps to try to remove those individuals who are in El Salvador because you believe that they didn't comply with your order a couple weeks ago, which the Supreme Court has said that you never had the jurisdiction to issue the order in the first place.
Yeah.
You see where we get? It's a mess. Look, I'm an attorney. I understand the process here, but I'm just going to be frank with you and for your listeners. This is a mess, and this is a constant. This is a mess. The best course of action here would have been to let sleeping dogs lie.
Yeah.
If you felt like you wanted to get your pound of flesh, Judge, then write an opinion. I can't do this, but if I could have done this, this is what I would have done. and then let the case rest.
So, Mike, listen, in about the minute and change we have left. So, are the nine justices of the Supreme Court, are they all looking at this saying, hey, we may not like this, but we may have to tell this guy to sit down and shut up? Oh, I mean,
They did that in so many words. We talk about the minimalism of the court, and they did that in so many words with that other order. Look, you don't have venue, you don't have jurisdiction, and remove it out. If you want to bring habeas proceedings, you can bring habeas petitions down in Texas or in Louisiana.
Yeah.
I don't know if this again is this an appealable order. We're getting into new territory here. I know this is a memorandum opinion, so I don't know if there do you comply with this. Do you take steps on this? I mean, so is this subject – does he stay this opinion until it's subject to an appeal? Do you move for a stay at the circuit court level before it gets up to the Supreme Court? This is just – This is a revivification. It's unnecessary at this point, and it simply smacks of partisanship. Wow. And I say that reluctantly to you, Paul.
Yeah. Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. Check him out online. Mike, great stuff as always. Thank you so much, and I'm sure we'll be talking down the road. Thanks, Mike.
Yep. Talk to you
soon. Appreciate it. There you go.